Hello, I'm Earl Fontenelle. This is the Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast. Today we are speaking with Sami Uli Karyanma, who is a docent of early Jewish and Christian literature at the University of Helsinki, and a man who has delved really deeply into the question of, well, many questions to do with the confluence of ideas in Alexandria in antiquity, but has written some really spectacular work on the idea of reincarnation among the Jews in this period. So, Sami, thank you so much for arranging to come on the podcast and talk about these subjects.
Thank you, Earl. I'm very glad to be here, and thank you also for your very kind words.
So, you've written a book-length monograph on reincarnation in Philo of Alexandria. That is something we want to talk about. But before we talk about that, I thought maybe bring up a more recent work you've done, which is an article on a question which a lot of people who aren't in sort of Jewish studies, biblical studies, won't know much about. But is this troubling evidence from Josephus that there's a school of Jews who believe in reincarnation? So let me build a little context here if I can. Funnily enough, weirdly enough, this will surprise non-specialists who don't know anything about this period. Our two most extensive sources, well, maybe our three most extensive sources for Judaism in the Near East and the sort of Eastern Mediterranean in the Roman period are all writing in Greek, and they are Philo of Alexandria, Josephus, and the New Testament, and, you know, works around the New Testament. Now, this is a weird state of affairs because you'd think there'd be a lot of like Hebrew literature or maybe Aramaic literature written by what you might think of as more traditional Jews, but there isn't. So we have this kind of Greek bottleneck in our evidence. And Josephus, so if we want to study Judaism in the crucial period before and during the Great Jewish War, which resulted in the Romans destroying the temple, we need to study Philo, Josephus, and the New Testament. Now, it's strange to many interpreters that Josephus says that there are three main, what he calls philosophies among the Jews. And these are the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. The Essenes are the sort of ascetic ones who go off in the desert. Often when people look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran documents, they say, ah, we found the Essenes that Josephus talks about. Debated, but anyway, they're doing a Dead Sea Scrolls type of thing. So then your other two big groups of Jews are the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and they also show up in the New Testament. The Sadducees don't believe in any life after death. They are, you die and you're dead people, right? And that leaves the Pharisees. What does Josephus say about that? Well, maybe before you get into your reading of Josephus, because it's very detailed, what is the sort of scholarly consensus about what Josephus says about the Pharisees in terms of eschatology?
Well, I'm not sure we can talk about a consensus because there's some variation in mm-hmm. the scholarly views. The basic alternatives are that he does seem to speak about reincarnation, but he really means the resurrection of the body. Or that he does seem to use reincarnational language, but we don't really know. We can't deduce what he actually means. Some scholars say, like I do, that he uses reincarnational language and means reincarnation. So I would say there is no real consensus on this matter.
Mm. But I have an imaginary scholar of Roman era, Tanaic era Judaism in my head jumping up saying, but we know that the Jews didn't believe in reincarnation. And then some of the evidence they're going to bring forth are, we know from the Enochic material and other Second Temple era material that there is this idea of a bodily resurrection. It's not necessarily that they make it, that they sort of approach it in a scientific, theological way and say, well, what kind of body is it? And da da da. But there's all this imagery of when God remakes the world, the righteous are going to have these lovely robes and these crowns, and they're going to be in the sort of heaven near God. There's going to be some palace-like stuff going on, and they're going to dwell there eternally. Very embodied imagery. This is the sort of apocalyptic Jewish model. This also is what we see in mainstream Christianity. It's what you sort of you see in Paul of Tarsus, this idea of you're going to be reborn, and it's going to be in this sort of hanging out with God forever type scenario. So that's the Jewish model. This is what this imaginary scholar is saying to me. If that's true, and there is no reincarnation, cyclical, repetitive reincarnation notion in Judaism in this time, either Josephus is wrong, or he's intentionally misrepresenting things for a Roman audience, maybe, or he's just not talking about reincarnation. He's talking about bodily resurrection, but he's using the language of maybe language that's more familiar to Greeks who've read Plato, using terms that are used in Greek to describe reincarnation, to describe these native Jewish ideas. But you disagree with that. So what is your sort of textual analysis of Josephus that says, no, he's really talking about reincarnation?
Well, let me just put forward a methodological point made by, for example, Steve Mason and others, namely that we should differentiate between a first phase, an exegetical phase, where we try to understand what Josephus is saying. And then the second phase is a historical one, where we delve into the question of the historical reality in Palestine at the time Josephus wrote. And my work has focused on the first phase. So really looking at the expressions Josephus is using and comparing them with what we know about the descriptions of resurrection, of the body or of the dead. This is often not so clear. And the language of reincarnation, in particular in Plato. And in the article you mentioned, I have looked at four passages, mainly in the Jewish War, the Jewish Antiquities, and Contra Apionem. Two of these describe the views of the Pharisees, but two actually are Josephus' own views. Now there is this question of whether he was a Pharisee or not, and I think the earlier consensus was, or the earlier view, that he was a Pharisee himself, but that has been questioned, so it's not really clear. He also says about the Essene doctrines that they are very, very, very attractive, so he seems to have a very positive view on them as well. But should we go to these four texts?
Why not? Let's talk about them.
I think the one I find particularly delicious in how it can be exegeted, if that's a verb in English.
It is now.
Yeah. Okay. This is in book four of the Jewish War. I think this was Josephus' talk to his troops against collective suicide. And in that talk, he twice refers to the soul being housed in the body. And in English translations, the similarities of these passages are not very obvious. For example, Thackeray translates the first one, the soul is housed in our bodies, and the second one, souls return to find in bodies a new habitation. The difference in Greek is much slighter, because in both Josephus talks about souls being housed in a body. But the only difference is that in the second one, he adds the adverb palin, meaning again, and then the prefix anti, meaning some kind of contrariety or repetition.
Or reciprocity, not, like one thing for another, one body for another body.
something is sort of reverted. And so
yeah.
The second passage really tells us that the souls are again sort of counter-housed. So it's a recurrence, something happens again, and the anti-prefix means that this second housing cancels out some earlier event, which in this passage or in this speech is that the souls go to heaven. So we have first this housing, and then heaven, and then another counter housing, which cancels the existence in heaven. So what scholars have, many of them, done is seen this latter passage as a reference to some kind of eschatological reception of a totally different kind of permanent resurrection body, which is not what Josephus is saying. The differences in Greek allow us to compare this latter passage to many other passages which have a very similar structure, Pauline and Antti. And I think the conclusion is very solid, that it's just another ordinary birth that takes place. And this is, I think, delicious, because it's so easy to show this. The differences, what they are and what their effect is, what the force of those Greek words is. And here also it's so easy to see how many scholars have had this prior conception of what he must be talking about, resurrection. So that's one example. Then in the Jewish antiquities, there's a passage that says that about the Pharisees now, they believe that souls have power to survive death, and that there are rewards and punishments under the earth for those who have led lives of virtue or vice. Eternal imprisonment is the lot of evil souls, while the good souls receive an easy passage to a new life. Here again, many have interpreted this as a reference to resurrection. But it's worth pointing out that the actual reward here is the ease of passage to a new life. And this then finds interesting parallels in Plato. For example, in the dialogue Phaedo, where there's a quite a detailed description of what souls of different degrees of goodness or evil will face in Hades. And for some it is very easy. They get to born. Reborn on earth easily, whereas for others they need to have their not so fun adventures in the water courses down below, and they need to be forgiven by those whom they have offended and so forth before they are allowed to be reborn. And here is also one particular thing visible, namely that while Josephus does really seem to take from Plato or echo Plato's descriptions of reincarnation, he only does this partially, because Josephus does not mention the reincarnation of bad souls at all. He has this division that, like in the citation I read, eternal imprisonment is their lot, and the good ones get to be transported to a new life. And this is fascinating, but I have no explanation why he does that.
it isn't without, I mean, if I can speculate on, let's just assume he knows some Plato. It isn't without Platonic parallels, because Plato does refer in one place, and I think it's even in the Phaedo. He mentions that in Phaedo 113e6, and also you can adduce the Gorgias and the Republic in certain places. I'll put the exact references in the notes, that incurable malefactors may end up in Tartarus. And the implication, it can, Plato, of course, doesn't make anything systematic, but the implication could be like, if you're really, really bad, you don't reincarnate. You end up in this place of punishment and you just stay there. So that is in Plato, or it can, at least can be found in Plato, right? What I'm interested in is the other end, because the other thing Plato hints at is that for some especially good souls, you might be able to escape and exist fully without the body, which you find in the Phaedo, which not all Platonist interpreters of Plato agreed with. Like, to take Proclus as an example, he says, no, 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 you eternally are going to reincarnate. This just goes on forever. Not eternally, but unlimited duration in time. But that's also to be found in Plato. So, but Josephus doesn't seem to run with that at all. He does, or if it's there in his theory, he doesn't mention it, right? He's just saying the two options are eternal punishment or a nice, easy reincarnation, right? So he doesn't have that upper, or you can just go be with God and not ever reincarnate again. That doesn't seem to be in Josephus.
There's a kind of parallel also for this not mentioning salvation, if you will, in the Republic. There's a vague hint at the very end for crossing the river, being saved. Plato doesn't elaborate, but I think it might be a reference to becoming liberated from the cycle of reincarnation. Although the main emphasis is strongly on the cycle, that it goes on and on. But Josephus leaves this out, and he leaves out also the reincarnation of the bad or imperfect souls. So that's. That would be worth further research.
Now, there's some other passages from Josephus that you analyze that maybe we don't need to get into in detail here. I recommend people just read your article. Mm. It's not very long. It's very accessible, even to non-specialists, I would say. So check that out.
And it's open access also. Yeah.
So we'll link to that, obviously. Just check the notes to this episode. Now, before we move on from Josephus, I'd like to ask you to speculate responsibly, if you can. So you've done the philological work. You've made a very strong case that he's talking about reincarnation. So if we agree with that, what do we make of it? Could it be that he's just a very educated Jew who's read a lot of Plato? And he's speaking to a Roman audience. So after the war, he becomes a traitor or just accommodates himself to the new regime, depending on how you want to read it. He goes to Rome. He hangs out with Vespasian and the Roman imperial court and writes these elegant histories of the Jews for a Roman audience. In doing so, he's probably influenced by his audience to some degree. So he wants to put things in a way that Greco-Romans are going to understand. So that might affect also the way he's presenting the Jews. I mean, just presenting the Pharisees and Sadducees and Essenes as philosophies within Judaism is already a cultural translation act, and there are many more cultural translation acts that he has to make. So what do you make of it? And please feel free to speculate as much as you want, as long as you say, I'm speculating, because that's what scholars are going to have to do, because the question becomes, is he accurately representing that there's this large group of Jews called the Pharisees who believe in reincarnation? What do you think? What do you make of it all?
Yeah, that's the second historical phase. Yeah. There is really a lot of work worth doing. Well, one of my Finnish colleagues, Erkki Koskenniemi, has argued that Josephus does not tone down Jewish religious phenomena. Where he is cautious is politics. So that might add some credibility to the speculative claim that someone may make, that Josephus is really describing the situation as it was in the field. But I'm not sure how to, because I'm immediately trying to think of ways of ascertaining that. We don't have that much material. The New Testament is, of course, relevant here. There we have the Pharisees believing in the resurrection of the dead. But at the moment, I'm not sure if there are mentions of the Pharisees believing in the resurrection of the body, because these are not necessarily the same thing. Philo would probably understand an expression like that as a reference to the upliftment of morally dead souls or something like that. So it's not clear even what the dead means here, at least not for me. But this is really hard to say. We know that the Jewish homeland had been under Greek influence for centuries. Since Alexander the Great, the influence was continuous. Was it Martin Hengels who said that all Judaism was Hellenistic Judaism at the time? Maybe just one more point, which is that I'm not aware of such, shall we say, dogmatic views within Judaism at that time that would have absolutely excluded the possibility. So, well, yes, there is the resurrection of the body, as we have, for example, in the Second Maccabees, where it really is concretely the same body that the souls will return. And that kind of excludes reincarnation. But what were the poll numbers at that time? How many people, Jews, really believed in that? Philo, for example, doesn't even seem to be aware of that idea.
Yeah. And if he was aware of it, he would have seen it as a unphilosophical, like, kind of folk belief that we're not even going to get into because we're doing something much more philosophically ambitious than that kind of stuff. I'm guessing.
Perhaps what I could say here is that in later Christianity, Clement of Alexandria, whom I also studied and found as one accepting reincarnation, he does seem to imply that this is a secret apostolic teaching going back to Jesus. He doesn't say this, but it sort of follows from what he does say, and this would hint at the possibility that there were also other strands of Jewish reincarnation belief than Philo in Egypt.
Yeah, indeed. Perhaps esoteric in the Jewish context as well. In other words, this is not the rank and file, but this is a select few who teach this in closed circles within the larger Jewish community. That seems very plausible to me. Let us turn to Philo. So we're now going back in time a generation or two, because Philo lived before the destruction of the Second Temple, while Josephus lived before, during, and after the destruction of the Second Temple. Now, Philo is an amazing, amazing author. We're lucky to have his works, mainly because he was sort of adopted by Christians, because so much of his theology was very useful for Christianity, and so many Christian authors were reading Philo that he just got copied. He becomes a sort of honorary Christian in the medieval tradition in a lot of places. And your book on Philo argues that, contrary to some interpretations, Philo does in fact support a reincarnationist view. And this is chiefly clear from his work on dreams, which is maybe his most extraordinary piece of writing, or it's definitely in the top five cool Philo pieces. So can you lay out your case for Philo, the believer in reincarnation?
Philo's case is very different from Josephus. It was actually the scholarly consensus from the 16th to the 19th century that he endorsed reincarnation. So in that sense, my results are nothing new. However, most of the positions taken by scholars during those centuries and also later were taken either offhand or just based on a few passages. So no comprehensive study existed before mine. And the work that you mentioned on dreams, that's the clearest case where Philo talks about reincarnation. And in scholarship, no serious alternative has been proposed for interpreting that passage, where he talks about souls after death being divided into different groups, some of which descend, or let's say first some of which ascend to be freed from bodily existence, whereas some who are lovers of the body and used to bodily things, they return. Philo doesn't say explicitly to the body, but nothing else remains as a viable option there. They return to the body.
Right.
And this particular passage is so saturated with Platonic expressions from several dialogues that it is very clear where the thought comes from.
Yeah.
Then there is a continuum of passages toward more vague expressions, which eventually raise the question of how does reincarnation really fit Philo's other views, more generally on the human being, on ethics, on salvation. And there we have very good harmony between those views and what reincarnation presupposes. In Philo we have this phenomenon of synergistic soteriology. Synergistic soteriology, which means that salvation out of this bodily existence in the Platonist and Philonic context is the result of cooperation between the human soul and God. By the way, there's some noise now coming through, humming.
Hmm.
Oh, it went away.
Yes, okay. I turned down my mic. Now I've turned it up again. Is it?
Yeah, it came back. Yeah.
It's just a little bit of background noise. It won't show up in the recording, so don't worry about it. I'll filter it out. Synergistic salvation.
Yes. Both have to do their part. And there's one passage in the Questiones in Exodum, where Philo describes the ascent of the soul based on Moses climbing to the mountain and being told by God to stay there or be there, that those who do not return do just that. They stay there through the grace of God. God decides whether they can stay. Mm. And happy are those who do not return, Philo says, to the extremes of Tartarus. He says, but Philo has no tolerance for any mythical underworld. He wants to hear nothing about that. Instead, it can be shown with the help of parallel passages that Tartarus is really the life of the wicked souls in the body for him.
Yeah.
Or imperfect souls. So they return. They are not allowed to stay in the divine city of God. That passage also very clearly shows Platonic influences, this time mainly from the Phaedrus. And in another passage, Philo says that after death, we will rush to a new birth. This is a passage in the treatise De Cherubim, 114, where most scholars, not all, but most have interpreted this as a salvific event. But the context rules that out. Philo is not talking about good souls ripe for salvation. He's talking about souls who are slaves to their senses and so forth. And in his synergistic soteriology, a soul could not simply rush to salvation. It needs the grace of God. And then the fourth passage, which I discussed in my book on Philo as one of direct evidence, is a snippet of text, a fragment for which we don't have the proper context, but in a very Platonic language, Philo says that death is followed by a revival in the same way as sleep is followed by awakening.
Yeah.
And even other scholars have pointed out the connections to the Phaedo in this context, but the conclusion has not been made before that the referent is reincarnation.
So it's one of these funny ones where it does seem like presuppositions about what Jews believed has influenced interpretation of Philo. So when Philo says things that are very they're scattered, they're not system, he doesn't have a treatise like on the afterlife or something like that, so you have to dig. But they're there, and he says, you're just reborn in a body, again and again and again. They just sort of say, well, he doesn't really mean it, or something like that. No one can deny it's there, but you can just kind of... He can't actually mean that, because he's a Jew, and we know that the Jews don't believe this. But it's there in the text. So this, to me... Okay, on the one hand, is in some ways less... shocking to our view of Judaism in the late Republican period, or early imperial period, because Philo is blatantly deeply read in Plato. He's blatantly also deeply read in Greek culture more generally. Like, he knows the dramatists. He's very interested in Pythagoreanism. He knows some Stoicism. He's a cultured guy he's not just open to Greek influence. He's deeply Hellenized, right? In that sort of sense of like an erudite thinker along Hellenic lines, as well as being a committed Jew. No problem for him. Shouldn't be a problem for us. We know it wasn't a problem for a lot of Philo's predecessors whose works doesn't survive, who were deeply Hellenized Jews of this sort of elite intellectual level. But so a priori, it shouldn't surprise us that he might be, even if we think there were no Jews who believed in reincarnation, it shouldn't surprise us that Philo could be the one who does, because he's so into Plato, right?
Yeah.
And yet, seemingly, you've been sort of fighting against the grain, the stream of scholarly opinion with your work. It does seem to be one of these things where people have read those passages and sort of just not quite seen them. They sort of didn't quite grapple with what he's actually saying and put it all together and go, oh, he actually just has a doctrine of cyclical reincarnation.
Yeah, I think there is some unwarranted caution here, reluctance to draw conclusions, and also valid questions. I mean, for example, if he accepts reincarnation, why does he not say it more clearly? Passage on the dreams, for example, I know scholars who accept that yes, reincarnation is what is talked about here, but it is so, I mean, it's so clear that it cannot be denied, but they treat it as an anomaly or a special case, where something comes to the surface which Philo may not have really integrated into his thinking, or something like that. But it's a good question why he doesn't talk about it more openly.
This brings us to the final question I wanted to ask you, which you were, which I mentioned in an email, and you were sort of hesitant about it. But this, to me, as a scholar of esotericism, is really interesting. Is it the case that Philo is intentionally expressing this in a kind of a way that's unmistakable for someone who's looking for it, but a way which can easily be missed by people who aren't looking for it, right? Using this technique often called Straussian esotericism. It's known in the Arabic tradition as Tabdid al-ilm, like the intentional scattering, something that we definitely know Clement does because he says he does it, but Philo doesn't say he does it. Is it not the case that that's what he's doing with this eschatological doctrine? And the reason he is doing it is because it is in some way esoteric teaching, such that he wants to write about it, but he doesn't want to write about it in a way that's accessible to just anyone. Is that that's my take on what he's doing, incidentally. I can't prove it. It's not susceptible to proof, but that just seems to me that these are not matters that you scatter before the masses. These are matters that are discussed in very select circles. There's a sort of, you know, Philo talks about an elite from time to time, the people who know how to read, how to do proper hermeneutics. And this seems to even transcend Judaism. This is just an elite that transcends all the religious confessions and is a kind of select brotherhood of people who just get it. Taking that notion alongside this sort of scattering of doctrines about reincarnation, could it not be the case that that's what he's doing? He's writing it publicly without writing it publicly. He's writing it publicly in such a way that only the people who get it in the first place will be able to even see it.
Something like that must be going on. After I wrote my book on Philo, I did study more the theory of esotericism, and I found particularly helpful Arthur Melzer's book, Philosophy Between the Lines. Very useful. And there Melzer differentiates between four kinds of esotericism. The first two kinds are meant to provide some kind of shelter from some negative effect whereas the other two seek to promote some positive effect. But these perhaps are the most interesting ones, these shielding forms of esotericism, which Melzer calls defensive and protective. Defensive meaning that you are defending yourself from some negative effect, and protective meaning that you are protecting your audience. So maybe Philo was engaged in defensive esotericism, protecting himself from some negative effect that openly discussing reincarnation might have caused. We know that his allegorical method has had its opponents. Mm-hmm. He talks about this generally, implies that his interpretations do not convince anyone, and certainly the interpretations of those other ones do not convince Philo. Yes. He mocks them, but maybe not in so crude ways that he would have jeopardized his position in the Jewish community. Because, you know, I think it's a millennia-long tradition in Judaism that you can disagree.
Yes.
But of course, there are some limits to that as well. But the question of Philo's reluctance, it sort of eludes us. And the fault is his. He doesn't say why he is not more open. It's a bit different when we go a few centuries forward to Clement, because we know we have in written statements explicit criticism of reincarnation, but we don't have that in Jewish sources.
Right. Yeah. We also have in Clement the helpful little hints scattered throughout the Stromates, where he says, I'm writing in a specific way such that I'm protecting the simpliciores, the more first stage Christians, from the doctrine which is known to the Gnostics, because it would just hurt them, right? So this, I guess, would be Meltzer's protective esotericism. I'm writing it, but in a way that if you're a beginner, you're not really going to understand it, so it won't affect you and you'll be fine. However, if the Gnostics want to approach my work, they will find the true kind of inner kernel. And he tells us he's doing that. So that's a wonderful and rare kind of example of someone in the Christian tradition saying, I am now writing esoterically, pay attention. We don't get that all the time. And then you get this falsifiability problem. It's like, you can't prove that he's doing that because he doesn't say he's doing that. You could just be reading your own stuff into Philo. Now, you have proven that Philo states that reincarnation occurs in numerous passages, especially in the on Dreams. But then if you accept On Dreams, then you look at his whole oeuvre and you can find other little splashes of reincarnation here and there. And you've also argued that this works great for Philo as a thinker. It's not some kind of extra appendix that doesn't really work with his whole worldview. It harmonizes it beautifully. So that work is done, in my view. The question then becomes, how does that teaching relate to his milieu, the Jewish community he sees himself as a part of, but also sees himself as maybe an elite part of? Not all the Jews are going to get him. That much is clear, right? Not all his Jewish brethren are going to be able to access his work and make sense of it. Probably not so much from the sort of polytheist world, because they don't seem to get so het up about religious beliefs. Like, you just kind of believe what you want. We don't really care, as long as you pay your taxes and so on, and don't start any riots. But yeah, what are the precise parameters of that esotericism, if it is esotericism? I think it has to be, no? I don't want to push your interpretation in the direction of mine, but to me, that just feels like a Clement-style, oblique referencing approach, with a view to keeping the pearls out of the hands of the swine, with a view to keeping the elite stuff for the elite readers who will get it.
I don't have any other explanation accept esotericism here, because, well, it's actually all over the place in Philo. He does speak of the initiates and so forth. Ignorant masses are a very recurring theme. Mm. But I don't think he invented it. I mean, within Judaism, his views are very Platonic, but we do have evidence from the previous, meaning the second century BCE. Aristobulus does write about Greek philosophers, and well, he says that they plagiarized Jewish thought, which is a recurring theme in Clement, not so much in Philo. Mm-hmm. But here the interesting point, I think, is the occurrence of similarities and harmony, regardless of who exactly it was that stole the ideas of the other. And I think that the gradually worsening position of the Jews in Alexandria in Philo's lifetime could have meant that it was not a good time to introduce new ideas from the Greek thought world. So yeah. I think he was part of a continuum also with regard to reincarnation, but an elitist continuum.
Sami, thank you so much for your insights on these two authors. Before I let you go, I'd love to invite you to speculate creatively one more time. If we look at Philo teaching reincarnation, and then we look at Josephus just a couple generations later, also saying, not well, in his speech to his troops that he records, arguing for reincarnation, but also saying, this is what some Jews believe. What kind of historical picture could emerge from this? And if we look at Philo specifically, I can think of two ways of looking at this. One, he's a Jew. The Jews don't believe in reincarnation. However, he's read a lot of Plato. He loves Plato. He finds a way to bring Platonist reincarnation ideas together with Judaism and create a new synthesis. Or two, there is already a reincarnationist tradition within Judaism. It's not what everyone believes, but it's there in some greater or lesser stream of thought. Philo is part of that stream, and then he finds a happy harmony in Plato, and he's able to link the two together. Probably not answerable, again, probably speculative, but which of these two do you think is more likely?
I think number two is definitely more likable. I like it more because it would provide more interesting research hypotheses, and I would love to really dig into it. I think we need to take into account what I said earlier, that should we say elitist Judaism everywhere in the Hellenistic world was in some way Hellenized. So you didn't say anything about the trying to trace the origins of the Jewish, you know, variety, non-Platonic Jewish variety of reincarnation belief, but it may not have been non-Platonic. After all, Palestine also was part of the Hellenistic world and had been for centuries. So, I don't know. I would like to think that there was this strand of reincarnational Judaism in many places around the Mediterranean, but what it first and foremost means to me is nice research hypotheses, which would be very, very beneficial for scholars to investigate.
A beautiful answer, careful and also inspiring for further research. Sami Ülkeryanma, thank you so much for talking about this window on our earliest evidence for Jewish reincarnation. And until we speak again, stay esoteric.
Thank you.